From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As the U.S. and British forces say they've taken parts of Basra and Baghdad, the Red Cross says the hospitals are overflowing with civilian casualties. Another American peace activist has been shot by Israeli forces in the occupied territories. We'll go to Jenin for a live report. An Intel computer program and U.S. citizen is being held in solitary confinement in Oregon. He's not been arrested, he's not been charged with a crime, and his attorneys are barred from talking about the case. We'll talk with a former Intel vice president. And we'll hear from Columbia University professor Manning Marable on the invasion of Iraq.
The right wing uses the cynical, hypocritical manipulation of turning a fact into its opposite. If you want to save the lives of the troops of our daughters and sons in the Middle East who have been stationed to carry out this unjust, immoral war by bringing these sisters and brothers home, you are accused of being the purveyor of terrorism, and you are accused.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. ground forces invaded Baghdad again today. U.S. officials say they've entered two palace complexes of President Saddam Hussein. At least two Marines were killed in fierce fighting at key bridges in the eastern part of the city. Reuters reports explosions continue in central Baghdad, including a residential district. Ambulances race through the streets. Information Minister Mohammed Saeed Al-Sahaf told reporters Baghdad is safe and claimed U.S. columns had been slaughtered and U.S. forces are committing suicide by the hundreds. In Saturday's raid, U.S. commanders claimed allies killed as many as 3,000 Iraqis, but commanders who conducted the raid said around 1,000 were killed. The Pentagon says both raids are shows of force meant to demonstrate to the Iraqi people U.S. forces can enter Baghdad at will. There was no immediate word on civilian casualties. Aid workers said on Sunday hospitals were already overwhelmed. The Guardian is reporting thousands of residents are fleeing in cars or on foot, many of them empty-handed or carrying only their children too young to walk in the midday heat. Many reports say one family was slaughtered at a U.S. checkpoint 5 miles from Baghdad Friday night as they attempted to flee. 15-year-old Omar lost his father, his mother, two sisters, a brother, and an uncle. Even the Marines were weeping in sympathy. The International Committee of the Red Cross said yesterday the number of casualties in Baghdad is so high that hospitals have stopped counting. ICRC staff in the capital said during the fiercest fighting, hospitals were receiving about 100 casualties per hour. The International Red Cross also said hospitals urgently need more water supplies. Given the general power outage in Baghdad, most hospitals and water installations are now being powered by backup generators. In town after town in the Iraq war zone, hospitals trying to cope with hundreds of wounded are cut off from medical resupply, aid officials reported on Sunday. An aid convoy destined for one overwhelmed hospital south of Baghdad was canceled because of U.S. military operations. A Reuters correspondent reports meeting a 12-year-old boy at Baghdad's Kindi Hospital. Ali Ismail Abbas said he was asleep when a missile fell on his home in eastern Baghdad. The missile killed his mother, father, brother, aunt, three cousins, and three other relatives. The blast also blew off both of his arms. He said, quote, "Our house was just a poor shack. Why did they want to bomb us?" The area in which he lived was surrounded by military installations. As he cried, he asked, "Can you help get my arms back?" Ambulance after ambulance raced in with casualties from around the Capitol. Victim after victim was rushed in, many carried in bedsheets after the stretchers ran out. Staff had no time even to clean the blood from trolleys. Patients' screams and parents' cries echoed across the ward. Doctors who treated Iraqi victims of two previous wars told Reuters they're taken aback by the injuries they have seen. One said, quote, "I've been a doctor for 25 years, and this is the worst I've seen in terms of number of casualties and fatal wounds," he said. "This is a disaster because they're attacking civilians. We are receiving a lot of civilian casualties," he added. The surgeon who repaired the broken back of Private Jessica Lynch says television coverage of the war is, quote, "disgustingly sanitized." Neurosurgeon Gene Bowles from Boulder, Colorado, told the Boulder newspaper, The Daily Camera, the daily White House press briefings also fall far short of conveying the brutality of war. Bowles is based in Landstuhl, Germany, the destination for the war's most wounded soldiers. As of Friday, nearly 300 patients had been brought to Landstuhl since the invasion started, and plane loads are arriving regularly. Bowles said he has seen soldiers with lost arms, legs, hands, burns, significant brain injuries, and peripheral nerve damage. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said yesterday, "It'll probably take more than 6 months to set up a new Iraqi government after coalition forces take full control of the country." He also said the United Nations should not be invited in to supervise and run the interim government. Wolfowitz's comments come as British troops are preparing to distribute 60,000 copies per day of a new pamphlet in Iraq. In the pamphlet, Prime Minister pledges that Iraq will be given self-government as soon as possible and that the UN will be involved. Meanwhile, the Financial Times is reporting both the main Kurdish and Shia opposition groups yesterday rejected U.S. plans to put Jay Garner, a retired general, in charge of post-war Iraq. A senior official of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Hamid al-Bayadi, said, quote, "We are concerned that this looks more and more like an occupation." And the U.S. military has secretly flown Ahmad Chalabi into southern Iraq. Chalabi is the controversial leader of one of Iraq's main opposition groups, the head of the Iraqi National Congress. Meanwhile, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports the pro-Israeli lobby in the U.S. AIPAC invited an unusual guest to address its annual convention, the head of the Washington office of the Iraqi National Congress, Intifad Kambar. Kambar's invitation to the conference appears to be the first time the two groups have disclosed their links after years in which the two sides have tried to conceal them. The London Observer reports one of the U.S. firms expected to land a massive reconstruction deal in post-war Iraq is facing a multi-billion-dollar lawsuit claiming it exploited and brutalized black workers in apartheid-era South Africa. Lawyers acting for thousands of victims of the racist regime are to file a detailed lawsuit against the Fluor Corporation in the U.S. this week. The lawsuits include the claim that Fluor hired security guards dressed in Ku Klux Klan robes to attack unarmed workers protesting against poor pay and conditions. British forces have invaded Basra after laying siege to the southern city for 2 weeks. British officials claim they are now in control of most of the city, but Iraqi resistance continues. Three British soldiers were killed in the attack. Reuters reports Brigadier General Robert Creer of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said it is necessary to control Basra to clear a route for crude oil exports. And UPI is reporting British officials believe it would be embarrassing for Prime Minister Tony Blair to meet President George Bush in Belfast today without British troops having substantially taken Basra. British troops have been camped outside Basra for 2 weeks while U.S. troops have rushed 300 miles north to Baghdad. But UPI reports some British officers say they see long-term trouble in reports that more than 2,000 Iraqis were killed by U.S. troops in Saturday's raid into Baghdad. With bitter experience of Northern Ireland, some of the British fear the number of deaths is too high and could result in recriminations against the Allies that will take many years to overcome. UN officials have rebuked British commanders for urging local residents of Basra to loot buildings belonging to the Iraqi army and the ruling Ba'ath party. The Times of London reports a senior British officer admitted they encouraged the looting for propaganda purposes. He said, "We believe this sends a powerful message that the old guard is truly finished." But UN officials said the British are violating the Geneva Convention. Homes and vehicles in Umkasr and Safwan, which have nothing to do with Saddam's regime, have been robbed and vandalized in recent days. A convoy of Russian embassy diplomats came under fire yesterday as they were being evacuated from Baghdad. The Kremlin said at least three people were injured. A Russian journalist with the group said that they were shot by U.S. forces. A U.S. F-16 warplane yesterday bombed a Kurdish convoy traveling with U.S. special forces in northern Iraq, killing at least 18 people. The bomb fell only meters from where the BBC World Affairs editor John Simpson was standing. He said it was, quote, "a scene from hell. Bodies burned around him. Pieces of bodies were strewn around. Vehicles were on fire." The BBC's translator, Kamran Abdurazak Mohammed, was killed, and the BBC's driver lost a leg. Witnesses said at least five of the vehicles in the convoy had blaze orange markings on their roofs meant to warn U.S. pilots, according to the Times. The three white BBC vehicles had the letters TV spelled out on their hoods. An Israeli soldier shot a U.S. peace activist in the face in the West Bank town of Jenin on Saturday. 24-year-old Brian Avery is in serious condition. Israeli forces have killed two more people in the Gaza Strip near the village of Musadar. One was a 13-year-old boy. And there have been mass protests. Thousands rallied against the war in Oakland over the weekend. Protesters in Italy and Crete also called on their governments to shut down U.S. military bases there. 50,000 marchers protested the war in Spanish pilgrimage town of Santiago de Compostela. Another 50,000 took place in rallies in Madrid. In Denmark's capital, Copenhagen, anti-war protesters threw human chains around the embassies of the U.S., Britain, and Spain. Thousands gathered in London in front of the U.S. Embassy demanding the resignation of British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Anti-war protesters also demonstrated in front of a Royal Navy base in Portsmouth in the south of England. Egyptian police arrested a prominent Egyptian-American civil rights activist and more than a dozen others after trying to hold an anti-war protest outside a mosque in Old Cairo. Ashraf al-Bayoumi was a chemistry professor at the University of Michigan and Alexandria University. 10,000 people demonstrated outside Cairo's Al-Azhar Mosque after Friday prayers. Thousands of protesters in Bahrain called on their government to expel the U.S. Navy Fifth Fleet, which is stationed there, and police used tear gas on several thousand protesters in Istanbul. Meanwhile, White House Special Envoy for the Western Hemisphere, Otto Reich, has lashed out at Caribbean nations for their opposition to the invasion of Iraq. The 15 Caribbean nations issued a resolution in February opposing the invasion. Reich was in Barbados last week for a regional trade and investment conference. In a televised interview, Reich warned the nations to, quote, "study very carefully not only what it says, but the consequences of what it says." Stop the War Now, the late Edwin Starr. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill, just back from Baghdad. And on the line with us right now from Baghdad, independent reporter Mei-Ying Welch. Welcome, Mei-Ying.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what is happening in Baghdad right now?
Well, we're seeing U.S. planes coursing overhead. They're just coming one every few minutes. They're flying low enough to actually see. Everybody here on the roof starts pointing. We hear them first, then we see them. There's still bombing going on around the city, sometimes it's close by, sometimes it's far away. Sometimes we can hear an exchange of artillery fire, and sometimes we can hear machine gun fire ringing out.
We are looking at the reports from the Red Cross of the overwhelming number of casualties in the hospitals. Have you been able to visit the hospitals?
No, I haven't been able to visit today because my guide didn't show up. That's something that happened to a lot of people here. You know, last night was such a tremendous battle, and in so many different parts of Baghdad, that we can't blame any Iraqi for not coming to work today. I mean, they, you know, their families are terrified, especially people who live in some of the southern area neighborhoods like Mansour, or living in some of the western areas. All of this has been going on sort of in a broad swath on the entire western side of Baghdad. Anyone who lives over there, you know, has to take care of a family that's sitting there absolutely terrified because they're right in their own neighborhoods hearing this artillery fire going off, hearing shots ringing out, even flying over their heads. Somebody told me that shots were flying over his head this morning. I mean, you know, this is a city of 6 million people, and it's like as if this were to happen in the city of Los Angeles or something. So it's, you know, hard to get people to come to work today.
We're seeing these images, Maying, of American tanks moving along the western bank of the Tigris River. There have been photos of tanks on the compound of the Al Rashid Hotel, U.S. tanks. What has this weekend battle that you were mentioning before, what has it looked like? What is the situation right now in the heart of the capital where you're speaking to us from?
Well, we were taken on a tour to actually see parts of the foreign ministry, the information ministry, the train station, and the bus station, which all composes the entire main city center part of Baghdad, where most of the important government buildings are, and it's really kind of the seat of the government, that whole neighborhood. We were taken on a bus tour to see it. We saw no evidence of U.S. forces at all. This is after the battle, the big battle this morning. No evidence of U.S. forces. We just saw a lot of Iraqi soldiers, and they had, you know, RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, launchers on their shoulders, and they were giving us the victory sign. We saw people, Iraqis, walking in and out of the information ministry, which is just a shell of a building, but nevertheless, we saw Iraqis walking in and out of it. So it seems clear that that was all under control. However, they didn't take us to see the Al Rashid Hotel, which is also just down the street. They studiously avoided it, and as we went by, we heard gunshots ringing out down the street. So it's very conceivable that U.S. forces are still in that area. We can't confirm it. All we can confirm is that the ministry refused to take us there and that we heard gunshots coming from that direction.
Have you gotten a chance, Maying, over the last few days to go to any hospital?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Have you gotten a chance over the last few days to go to any hospital?
Yes, I went to Al Kindi Hospital yesterday. That's a hospital that serves mostly civilians. And there were at least 150 casualties yesterday, most of them, the vast majority of them being civilians. The day before that, there were 130 casualties in the space of only 4 hours, 2 o'clock until 6 o'clock in the evening. You know, that hospital has taken a lot of casualties. But the hospital that's really been taking a lot of casualties, we're no longer allowed to visit. That's Yarmouk Hospital, which serves the southern end of Baghdad. Right now there's another plane coursing overhead, very loud. It's gone right over my head. It's some kind of jet fighter. The Yarmouk Hospital has essentially, even though it is a teaching hospital, has essentially become a military hospital. I mean, because there's been so many battles on the southern end of the city, and we were taken to see the area just south of the University of Baghdad, which was clearly the site of a huge battle. There were burned military vehicles, abandoned anti-aircraft batteries and artillery pieces, and an American tank that had been burned up, and the entire highway had been sort of ripped into pieces. You know, so that hospital, which serves that area, has apparently been taking hundreds of dead and wounded Iraqi soldiers. We can no longer go to that hospital.
We're talking to Maying Welsh. She is in Baghdad right now at the Palestine Hotel. What about the Al Rashid Hotel and the Information Ministry? We hear that it has been surrounded.
Well, I was there earlier today, and I can tell you that, you know, the Information Ministry, which is nothing but a shell of a building and has no government activity whatsoever going on inside of it that I know of, because, you know, the information ministry has moved over here, where I am, was surrounded by Iraqi forces this morning and had, as I said before, Iraqi workers, or I don't know who they were, kind of going in and out of the main entrance. You know, it's not possible that U.S. forces, they were saying that they controlled that building, or that they were at least in the vicinity of it, about a half an hour or 45 minutes before I saw it with my own eyes. And I can tell you it's not true that they were there. If they were ever there, they left.
The Iraqi Information Minister, Mohammed Saif al-Sahaf, has been really attacked over the entire weekend. Paul Wolfowitz saying that he's like something out of a Saturday Night Live skit, and also several newspapers have printed attacks on him and his credibility for statements where he said, for instance, that what we're seeing is a movie, that the images of U.S. forces moving into Baghdad, being at the airport, that it's all a scene from a movie. Talk about what the Iraqi government is saying right now. And has anyone besides any senior officials appeared in public besides the information minister, Mohammed Sahaf?
Well, Mohammed Saeed Sahaf did come out with a statement today saying that there are no longer any U.S. forces in Baghdad. You know, perhaps when he was talking that was true. I don't think it could be true now because we're still hearing these battles going on. You know, these are not far away sounds. These are close by sounds. You know, and this morning I saw with my own eyes the battle for the presidential palace. I saw it. I saw people running away from the scene. I saw oil fires that had been set by the Iraqis put out by somebody, I can only assume by Americans. You know, I saw puffs of smoke going up and massive amounts of machine gun fire. There's no doubt that U.S. forces were in the heart of Baghdad today. No doubt about it. Whether or not they were not any longer here when he made that statement, I don't know. Whether or not they're here right now, I think they must be because of these sounds that we're hearing of a battle. You know, I mean, just basically the statements coming out of the Iraqi government and the statements coming out of the Pentagon have generally been so totally at odds with one another, it's incredible. I mean, the information minister has also been maintaining consistently that the U.S. force no longer holds Saddam International Airport, because it is in fact controlled by Iraqi forces. You know, also, I mean, every day we hear reports that, you know, three American APCs were destroyed by Saddam Hussein. Two tanks were destroyed. 50 soldiers were killed in this area, in that area, in this area. And then when you look at what the Pentagon says, oh, well, we had a friendly fire accident over here, and a helicopter fell out of the sky because of a mechanical problem there. You know, I mean, it's the fog of war. It's who's telling the truth, and how can we confirm it? I mean, there's a propaganda war going on here, and we just have to do our best to try and figure out who's telling the truth. I think there are U.S. forces in this city.
Is it your understanding that thousands of Iraqi troops have been killed in Iraq, in Baghdad, at this time, over the weekend?
Well, I know people who saw hundreds and hundreds of dead bodies coming into soldiers coming into Yarmouk Hospital over this weekend. And so I think it's conceivable. Also, you know, I mean, people are being encouraged to martyr themselves to get the U.S. forces out of here. So I think it is conceivable that thousands have been lost, or a thousand have been lost, or at least hundreds, very, very many people have died, I'm sure.
Did you hear that a cargo plane, a C-130 cargo plane, landed at the airport yesterday?
Yes, I heard that. I haven't seen pictures of it. I would like to know if there are any pictures of it. You know, I mean, at this point, it's kind of, you know, show and tell. At this point, you have to show what you're talking about. You know, I mean, this morning, the ministry put its money where its mouth was, and they showed us that U.S. forces do not control the Ministry of Information and do not control the Foreign Ministry. You know, however, they didn't show us that they don't control the Al-Rashid Hotel. And they've been telling us all along that they control Saddam International Airport and promising us a trip, and yet that they never take us. So, you know, until we see with our own eyes anything, it's all very dubious.
So you very much feel like captive right now? in terms of what you can go out and see? When do they decide when they will take you out? And how many reporters are at the Palestine Hotel?
I would say there's about 250 at least journalists from all around the world here, and they really are from all around the world. I'm one of the very few Americans here. People are here from Vietnam and Chile and Russia, from everywhere you can imagine. We are generally given three buses. We pack onto these buses. They're standing room only. We're taken on at least one tour a day, sometimes two. These tours are decided very carefully by the Ministry of Information, some kind of consultation process with the military. Besides that, we are allowed to go in private cars with a guide, of course, from the Ministry of Information. We are allowed to go to certain hospitals to check on civilian casualties, and we're allowed to go, say, to the general marketplace. However, I think a lot of that has been canceled today.
Also, I noticed that the daily newspapers in Iraq have now stopped printing.
That's right. We no longer get the daily newspaper. And Iraq Daily, which is the English-language newspaper, has become Iraq Weekly.
And what about water and electricity? Do you have access to both? Is there electricity in Baghdad?
Well, they said they were putting it back together, yet another plane. I mean, really, every 2 minutes there's another plane flying overhead. They said they were putting the power back together, but frankly, last night it was pitch dark everywhere I looked in Baghdad, and I don't have electricity in my room. We still have water. We still do have water, so that hasn't gone away yet.
If there isn't electricity, then there isn't water purification. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, technically, there shouldn't be any water. Because the reason I have water is because we have a backup generator in this hotel. And it's used for just really essential things like keeping the lights on in the lobby and pumping the water. So the average person, if they don't have power in their house, they don't have water either. And of course, you know, a lot of these water treatment facilities and these hospitals, they also have backup generators. The Iraqis planned for this. They expected to lose power. They expected the power stations would be bombed. So they had backup generators for all the really essential services. So I think right now water in Baghdad is still all right, unless people are getting it from a well.
And then briefly, Mei Ying, on the issue of senior Iraqi leadership, have any of them appeared in public or addressed reporters, the Iraqi vice president, the foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, have any of these people been seen over the weekend besides Mohammed Sahaf, the information minister?
No, we haven't seen these people today, just Mohammed Sayed Sahaf.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Mei Ying Welsh, speaking to us from Baghdad, speaking to us from the Palestine Hotel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mei Ying Welsh in Iraq. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Jenin in the West Bank. Stay with us.
As I raise my hand to broadcast my objection, Jenin's triumph draws the final straw. Died and lifted you up to perfection, and what silenced me is written into law. I can't believe what circumstances thrown me, and I turn my head away. If I look, I'm not sure that I could face you. Not again, not today, not today. If hatred makes a play on me tomorrow, and forgiveness take a backseat to revenge, there's a hurt down deep that has not been corrected. There's a voice in me that says you will not win.
The Final Straw, REM, their new anti-war song. This is the War and Peace Report, Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For the second time in a month, a U.S. peace activist has been shot by Israeli forces in the occupied territories. The victim is 24-year-old Brian Avery. He's in serious condition. He's regained consciousness and is able to communicate by writing messages, but his face is said to be shattered, with his tongue split in two. Eyewitnesses and members of the International Solidarity Movement say Avery was shot by an Israeli tank. Israel says the shooting is under investigation. This comes just weeks after Rachel Corrie of Olympia, Washington, was shot dead in the Gaza Strip. We turn now to our guests in Jenin. We begin with Tobias Carlson. He witnessed the shooting of Brian Avery. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, and I hope you can hear me well, because I seem to have some problems with hearing you.
We can hear you fine. Tobias, can you tell us exactly what happened and where it happened?
Well, this incident, it took place in central Jenin on Saturday, and I want to give you some brief background to put this into a context, that Jenin had at this point been under curfew for almost 48 hours, and there had been some disturbances in the central city with children of Jenin sometimes throwing stones and objects at heavily armed Israeli vehicles, and Israeli vehicles in some incidents respond to this with firing live ammunition upon the children. And luckily, no one had been injured within these 24 hours, but less than 2 weeks before, they had killed two boys, 14 and 15 years old, in similar circumstances. We here as ISM activists, we try to be out on the streets in similar situations to monitor and to try to prevent the Israelis to fire upon these kids. They are still considered civilians due to international law, however, even if they're throwing stones. And it's a violation for the Israeli army to fire live ammunition upon civilians. So me and Brian was sitting on the roof to our apartment at around 6:15 p.m. on Friday. On Saturday, when we heard vehicles, tanks or APCs, we couldn't see, so we couldn't tell at that moment, approach the area and turn into a street about two blocks away from where our apartment is located. And they stopped in this street, and shortly afterwards we heard two bursts of firing from what we could tell is the main mounted machine gun on these vehicles. And concerned about this firing, we couldn't see where they were, so we decided to go out onto the street to see if there was any to check up on the situation and the possibility that they were firing at unarmed civilians. It's important to emphasize that we could at no time during this whole incident hear any kind of firing from any kind of Palestinian resistance fighters. We can clearly distinguish the sound between M16 light firearms and these heavy caliber mounted machine guns. And during these whole 48 hours of curfew, there had been no armed resistance whatsoever in Jenin. Me and Brian goes out on the street and decide to wait for some of our colleagues, international volunteers, to join up with us before we approach these vehicles at the scene. So we're standing in a crossroad some blocks away from our building, waiting for our friends to approach from a different direction, when we suddenly hear these vehicles moving towards us. Shortly after, they become visible to us, and the situation I can describe as normal for our conditions in Palestine. There is nothing odd about this to us, to face the Israeli army's vehicles, and we do it all the time. And they are driving towards us at a very slow speed, less than 10 kilometers an hour. And at this time, there is no one on the street except for me and Brian and our friend. He's a Palestinian medical volunteer. Brian is clearly identified by a fluorescent red vest with the reflective details. And our Palestinian friend, he's hiding behind the corner out of fear of these armed vehicles, so they can never see him at any time. And also our friend is now approaching the scene from another direction, from an opposite direction from the armed vehicles. When these vehicles are approaching us, me and Brian is standing in the street, making ourselves as visible as possible, as is normal procedure for us. We are standing with our hands in the air, and we have the vehicles visible for us and us visible for the vehicles for at least 15 seconds before they suddenly open fire at us, straight in our direction and straight in front of our feet from a distance of approximately, I would say, 50 meters. And as international volunteers and activists here, we are kind of used to the Israelis firing somewhat in our direction, in the air over our head or on the side of us. But this situation was different, since they're firing straight in our direction, and they're also firing from a moving vehicle without them stopping to take proper aim. And, of course, these bullets, they bounce to the ground and they continue straight towards us. And at this point, I myself feel lots of objects showering all over my body, and I end up with some small scratches and bruises. And instinctively, I take a few steps to the side and I jump away for maybe 3 or 4 steps. Then I turn around and looking in the direction where Brian was standing, and I can see him lying on the ground, face down, and a big pool of blood spreading around his face. What the soldiers do, I mean, there is no doubt whatsoever in my mind that they, before firing, identified us as international volunteers or international observers, since they are very used to our presence. We have interfered with these soldiers on many occasions prior to this incident. And there is no doubt that they knew who we were. There were no Palestinians in the area that could have been the target for this firing, and it's directed strictly towards us. And after they fired this, they basically continue driving at the same speed. They pass the spot where Brian is lying, and we're trying to help him and provide first aid, and continue driving and drive away. There is no intent whatsoever to try to check up on our situation or to provide any kind of assistance to us. At this point, we call an ambulance. As soon as Brian hits the ground, of course, we call an ambulance from the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, and this ambulance arrives within 3 to 5 minutes, I would say, and take Brian for emergency care at the Jenin Governmental Hospital. And from this hospital, he is later transferred. This process of transfer is delayed for, I would say, up to 2 hours from the Israeli army. We have to have the permissions from them to move him. And when we get it after around 2 hours, he's transferred, and he's now currently in a hospital in Haifa inside Israel.
And what is his condition?
His current condition is, I mean, it's not at this point life-threatening, to my knowledge, but still it's very serious, and he has very severe facial injuries. And I was very surprised when my colleagues who are with him in the hospital informed me that he was actually conscious today and that he was able to communicate somewhat by writing notes and using his hands. He can't talk, of course, and he has got several fractures on several bones in his facial area, but I don't really at this point have the exact medical details on it. But I'm informed that he will have to be subject to months of plastic surgery and medical treatment to somewhat restore his face. And I don't know if he will ever, if he will suffer any permanent disabled from this injury. And this is pretty much what I know about it at this point.
Tobias, this is the anniversary of the Janine slaughter a year ago. What is happening in regard to that?
In regard to that, there was a program planned with lots of cultural activities, exhibitions, and lectures and speeches around this in the Janine camp and in the area that is now totally destroyed. And it's like a desert landscape in the middle of the camp. It's totally surreal. However, the only incident that actually could take place was one demonstration held last Thursday, I think. Yeah, Thursday. And everything since that has been cancelled due to the curfew that the Israelis imposed on Janine and the camp at 4 o'clock in the morning on Friday.
And so, what is the Israeli military saying happened to Brian Avery?
I have read some articles claiming a statement from the Israeli army spokesperson stating that there was a firefight going on between Palestinian resistance and the Israeli army at this point. But to me, that is an outrageous lie to cover up the circumstances of this attempted murder on international activists. What I can say about this, we had people out in the city and there was clashes between children, and I emphasize children, throwing stones at armed vehicles earlier on this day, but they took place in a total different area of the city and they had ended at least 1 hour before this incident took place. I emphasize again that at this point, when the Israeli armed personnel carrier opens fire upon us, me and Brian are the only persons visible at that street. They are not under any kind of attack from any kind of Palestinian resistance, or not even from the children throwing stones at them. They drive in a very slow manner. The situation is totally calm, and to us it seems very normal for Palestinian conditions, so to say. So I was actually extremely surprised that they opened fire at us at this particular moment. There was really nothing going on.
Because the Israeli military said that they were being fired on by Palestinian fighters.
And again, I repeat that this is not truth. And I mean, we are here as international solidarity movement volunteers. And what we do as international solidarity movement is to try to protect and support the Palestinian civil community, and there is no way that we would deliberately go into an area where there is an actual firefight going on. That would be stupidly dangerous, of course, to try to go in and interfere in a situation like this as some kind of civilian human shield, and it's totally out of the question that we would take any kind of action like that. So this is simply not true.
We've been talking to Tobias Carlson, who was with Brian Avery when the Israeli military shot him, when he was shot by an Israeli tank in Jenin. We are also joined on the telephone by Danny Muller in Chicago, who is a close friend of Brian Avery, who, by the way, lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Danny Muller has is with Voices in the Wilderness, has been to Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Danny.
Good morning, Amy.
Can you tell us about who Brian is?
Sure. Brian was a roommate of mine out here in Chicago. We all lived at the Stone Soup community, and we worked on a lot of justice issues together. He went over in January, and we've been talking by email since. He's a really amazing person, probably one of the most nonviolent people I've ever met. He's just so kind-hearted, and I mean, this is beyond shocking. I emailed him 2 days before, and we had just been communicating, and I just can't. This person just emanates warmth and goodwill. He's just so kind-hearted. It's just, well, all of us are really upset about it, and we just can't imagine. You know, this bullet that flew through the air probably came with a U.S. red ribbon on it. You know, it was probably said made in the U.S. and it went into him. That's part of our shock here, of our own responsibility for it, and just the recognition that Brian went as a representative for us. You know, he went for all of us who care about this issue and care about people there, and he was there speaking for us, and this is what happened to him, and I think that talks to us in a way that we really need to reevaluate what we're doing here and stand with Brian right now and do what we have to do to make sure. I mean, this is as shocking as it's shocking, the bullets that go into Palestinian children on a regular basis, and that's why Brian was there. I mean, I have an email here from him that he just sent the night of the start of the Iraq War, and he describes some of what he was going through. I think it's really important to hear his words. There's not too much out there that he's written. And he was speaking about how the death of Rachel has definitely been a heavy blow to everyone here. You know, we were at the same training back in January, and she was a really sweet person. He's speaking about the soldiers. He says they're amazing. The psychology these kids display is truly a sight to be seen, and I do mean kids. Half of them are fresh conscripts thrown into the wild Palestine yonder, no more than 18. They really have no clue to the great politics of this thing, and the few that do are incredibly cynical and sadistic about it. All of them are terrified, though. They clutch their guns like teddy bears, as though every Palestinian is about to tear out their hearts and eat them and treat every person like nothing. The tanks and APCs are rolling around night and day, and they love to come into the camps in the city in the middle of the night and start destroying houses in the process, if not just simply occupying them and holding a family inside hostage until they're off to the next supposed home of terrorists. I tell you, this place is really shit a lot of the time. The only thing that makes it worthwhile is these Palestinians, though their generosity is a true display of incredible hospitality, enough to make you laugh and cry.
And that was a letter of Brian Avery.
Yeah, he wrote that the night of the Gulf War. He says, I can only imagine the Iraqis are much the same. My thoughts are with them tonight.
And Danny Muller, as you've gone to Iraq and you listened to what happened to your friend in Jenin, your final thoughts?
Well, I can only say personally just my own intentions, which are to go down to the Israeli embassy today, to go down to the federal building, go down to Boeing, probably where this bullet was made, and I'm just not going to leave. And that's the least I can do for my friend, and I think that's the least a lot of us can do right now. And I think not taking no for an answer and getting an explanation and getting an investigation and getting reparation for people here in Chicago and in New Mexico and in Palestine and in all these places affected by these bullets that shouldn't be flying through the air that we're paying for. And, you know, tax day is coming up next Tuesday, and I think a lot of us are resisting our taxes for exactly this reason and redirecting them to places like Palestine and places like Iraq, and exactly for the reasons that Brian was there for and exactly for the reasons that Brian's in the hospital right now.
As you are a member of Voices in the Wilderness, as we wrap up, any word from Kathy Kelly on the ground in Baghdad, the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness?
Yeah, we received word from our 13 people there over the weekend, which was the first word we had received, that they were safe. They've continued every day to go to bomb sites and to go to the hospitals. The sites are as horrifying in their description of destruction of people's bodies with weaponry that's used to go through tanks and houses. And, you know, we've had a very hard time with communication, but we're just very glad to know they're safe and continue to listen to their reports, which can be gotten at the IraqPeaceTeam.org website and at electronicIraq.net.
Well, I want to thank you, Danny Muller, for being with us.
Thanks, Amy.
Danny Muller of Voices in the Wilderness, his friend Brian Avery, shot by an Israeli tank on Saturday. He remains in serious condition in the hospital. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
War. Here they build the big guns. Here they build the death planes. Here they build all the bombs. Here they hide behind walls. Here they hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but built to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain. Like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
Bob Dylan, Masters of War, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. His name is Mike Hawash. He's a father, a computer programmer with Intel, a U.S. citizen. You could say he led a typical life until less than 3 weeks ago when he was surrounded by officers from the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in the Intel parking lot. He was taken into custody as a material witness in an undisclosed court case. He's now being held in solitary confinement. He's not been technically arrested, but he could be held indefinitely, with the government never pressing charges, and his lawyers are barred from talking about the case. You could say he's almost been disappeared. That might have been the case, except for colleagues of his in the tech world. Steve McGreedy is a former vice president of Intel who worked with Mike Hawash, created a website titled FreeMikeHawash.org to raise awareness about the case, and he joins us now on the telephone. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, what happened?
I got a call a little over 2 weeks ago now, almost 2.5 weeks, from a friend of mine who had heard that Mike had been arrested and was very surprised. Mike's not the kind of guy that we would expect that to happen to. And gave me a call. Mike worked for me for almost 10 years on and off when I was a vice president at Intel. I did some calling. I called his attorneys when I found out who they were. I called the U.S. Attorney's Office. I called the FBI. And quickly found out, I think what you've just described, no one was able to say anything about what had happened to him, why he was arrested. But what really started getting me crazy was they wouldn't tell me what judge had signed the warrants. They wouldn't tell me what U.S. attorney was assigned to the case. They wouldn't tell me, they wouldn't even confirm that he was being held, although I knew that he was from his wife, who had unfortunately just been woken up the previous morning by 20 FBI agents and wearing bulletproof vests and carrying assault rifles, along with her three children, Mike's and her three children. So I was just increasingly alarmed. This is not something that you're used to happening. You're used to hearing about a friend of yours being carried away, and certainly you're not used to hearing about it happening all in secret. So that's when I called a few other friends, and we got together and published a website and started agitating to find out what had happened to our friend.
Looking at a report on his case in Wired News, it says that Mike Hawa, she is an Arab American.
Yeah, Mike, well, first of all, Mike's a U.S. citizen. He's lived in the U.S. for almost half his life, for nearly 20 years. He's just been a citizen for 15 years. But yeah, he was born in the Palestinian town of Nablus, exiled by the Israelis in, I think, 19, I don't know at what time, although he grew up in Kuwait until he was about 18 when he moved to this country to go to the University of Texas. And he's lived here ever since, and lived in particular here near Portland, Oregon, since 1992.
And it says that possibly he was targeted because of charitable donations he made in 2000 to the Global Relief Foundation, a Muslim charity that funds mosques and schools in the United States, as well as West Bank medical facilities.
Well, any idea about why he was picked up really is just speculation, because all of the documents are sealed. And in the initial press reports of his arrest, his donations to Global Relief, which were made three or more years ago, long before 9/11, were discussed. And Mike had been previously questioned about that, and we're now pretty sure that that doesn't have anything to do with it. Nonetheless, even if they did, his donations to that were made at a time when that was considered to be a completely legitimate relief organization.
So what are you doing now?
Well, there is frighteningly little we can do. We have obviously been trying to raise media awareness. We have very specifically been encouraging people to write to their congresspeople, their U.S. senators and representatives, because Mike, sadly, is not unique. He's not the only Arab American who's being held as a so-called material witness, which is to say without charges, likely without the intent of ever filing charges. There are Arab men without the kinds of network of friends that Mike has around the country who've been held as long as about 16 or 18 months, to the best of our knowledge. So we're encouraging people to write their congressmen we're encouraging people to, if they're able to donate money to a legal defense fund. Early estimates are that Mike's legal defense could exceed $100,000. And we're encouraging people to spread the word. Make sure that Mike's isn't forgotten. One of the things that I always think about on this that has motivated me along the way the last few weeks is the idea that he wakes up in a federal prison every morning, not really knowing why he's there and not knowing if there's anybody out there other than maybe his wife or his family working for his release. And I think now that he knows, because he has been able to communicate with his wife, now that he knows we're working for him, hopefully he doesn't feel quite so alone.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden says he's going to start looking into the case.
Actually, yes. Well, yeah, Senator Wyden's office...
We have 10 seconds, 5 seconds.
...has gotten a letter back from the U.S. attorney, which basically says, Senator Wyden, we can't tell you anything until May.
Well, I want to thank you, Steve McGreedy, for being with us, former vice president at Intel, the boss of Mike Hawash for 10 years. FreeMikeHawash.org is the name of your website. That does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, no arrival. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As the invasion of Iraq approaches its third week, we host a roundtable discussion with the editors of The Nation, Z Magazine, and Counterpunch. Katrina Vandenhoevel, Michael Albert, and Alexander Coburn will join us. We go to the streets of New York, where protesters are demonstrating against the Carlyle Group, and we'll talk to the Red Cross about the hospitals of Baghdad overflowing with casualties. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. ground forces invaded Baghdad again today. U.S. officials say they've entered two palace complexes of President Saddam Hussein. At least four Marines were killed in fierce fighting at key bridges in the eastern part of the city. U.S. military officials have just announced two U.S. soldiers and two journalists have been killed and 15 people wounded in an Iraqi rocket attack on a U.S. position south of Baghdad. No further details are available as of yet. Reuters reports explosions continue in central Baghdad, including in a residential district. Ambulances are racing through the streets. But Information Minister Mohammed Saeed Al-Sahaf told reporters Baghdad is safe and claimed U.S. columns had been slaughtered and U.S. forces are committing suicide by the hundreds. In Saturday's raid, U.S. commanders claimed allies killed as many as 3,000 Iraqis, but commanders who conducted the raid said around 1,000 Iraqi soldiers were killed. The Pentagon says both raids are shows of force meant to demonstrate to the Iraqi people U.S. forces can enter Baghdad at will. The International Committee of the Red Cross said yesterday the number of casualties in Baghdad is so high that hospitals have stopped counting. ICRC staff in the capital said that during the fiercest fighting, hospitals were receiving around 100 casualties per hour. The ICRC also said hospitals urgently need more water supplies. Given the general power outage in Baghdad, most hospitals and water installations are now being powered by backup generators. In town after town in the Iraq war zone, hospitals trying to cope with hundreds of wounded are cut off from medical resupply. An aid convoy destined for one overwhelmed hospital south of Baghdad was canceled because of U.S. military operations. A Reuters correspondent reports meeting a 12-year-old boy at Baghdad's Kindi Hospital. Ali Ismail Abbas said he was asleep when a missile fell on his home in eastern Baghdad. The missile killed his mother, father, brother, aunt, three cousins, and three other relatives. The blast also blew off both his arms. Ambulance after ambulance raced in with casualties from around the capital. Victim after victim was rushed in, many carried in bedsheets after the stretchers ran out. Staff had no time even to clean the blood from the trolleys. Patients' screams and parents' cries echoed across the ward. Doctors who treated Iraqi victims of two previous wars told Reuters they're taken aback by the injuries they have seen. One said, quote, "I've been a doctor for 25 years, and this is the worst I've seen in terms of the number of casualties and fatal wounds," he said. "This is a disaster because they're attacking civilians." He added, "We are receiving a lot of civilian casualties." Meanwhile, The Guardian is reporting thousands of residents are fleeing in cars or on foot, many of them empty-handed or carrying only their children too young to walk in the midday heat. One family was slaughtered at a U.S. checkpoint 5 miles from Baghdad Friday night as they attempted to flee. 15-year-old Omar lost his father, his mother, two sisters, a brother, and an uncle. The Observer reports even the Marines were weeping in sympathy. On the other side of the war, the surgeon who repaired the broken back of Private Jessica Lynch says television coverage of the war is, quote, disgustingly sanitized. The neurosurgeon, Gene Bowles, from Boulder, Colorado, told the Boulder newspaper The Daily Camera the daily White House press briefings also fall far short of conveying the brutality of war. Bowles is based in Landstuhl, Germany, the destination of the invasion's most wounded soldiers. As of Friday, nearly 300 patients had been brought to Landstuhl since the invasion started, and plane loads are arriving regularly. Bowles said he has seen soldiers with lost arms, legs, hands, burns, significant brain injuries, and peripheral nerve damage. A convoy of Russian embassy diplomats came under fire yesterday as they were evacuating from Baghdad. The Kremlin said at least three people were injured. Russian media are reporting that two bullets from the stomach of one victim came from an M16 semi-automatic assault rifle, which is used by U.S. Marines. But U.S. Central Command and Qatar said initial reports indicate there were no U.S. or British troops nearby. Meanwhile, the Russian diplomats are attempting to continue their journey to Syria, where a medically equipped Russian aircraft is waiting. But Russian news agencies say U.S. military commanders are hindering the progress of the convoy by altering its route and refusing to provide safety guarantees. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said yesterday it will probably take more than 6 months to set up a new Iraqi government after coalition forces take full control of the country. He also said the United Nations should not be invited in to supervise and run the interim government. Wolfowitz's comments come as British troops are preparing to distribute 60,000 copies per day of a new pamphlet in Iraq. In the pamphlet, Prime Minister Tony Blair pledges that Iraq will be given self-government as soon as possible and that the UN will be involved. Meanwhile, the Financial Times is reporting both the main Kurdish and Shia opposition groups yesterday rejected U.S. plans to put Jay Garner, a retired general, in charge of post-war Iraq. A senior official of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Hamid al-Bayati, said, quote, "We are concerned that this looks more and more like an occupation." And the U.S. military has secretly flown Ahmad Chalabi into southern Iraq. Chalabi is the controversial leader of one of Iraq's main opposition groups, the head of the Iraqi National Congress. Meanwhile, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports the pro-Israeli lobby in the U.S. AIPAC invited an unusual guest to address its annual convention, the head of the Washington office of the Iraqi National Congress, Entefat Kanbar. Kanbar's invitation to the conference appears to be the first time the two groups have disclosed their links after years in which the two sides have tried to conceal them. The London Observer reports that the Fluor Corporation, one of the U.S. firms expected to land a massive reconstruction deal in post-war Iraq, is facing a multi-billion dollar lawsuit claiming it exploited and brutalized black workers in apartheid-era South Africa. When the new Iraqi school year begins in 5 months, the Bush administration hopes to have in place new textbooks that teach a curriculum more in line with U.S. interests in Iraq. The Washington Post reports the U.S. Agency for International Development is preparing to award education-related contracts worth an estimated $65 million. British forces have invaded Basra after laying siege to the southern city for 2 weeks. Three British soldiers were killed in the attack. British officials claim they're now in control of most of the city, but Iraqi resistance continues. Reuters reports Brigadier General Robert Creer of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said it's necessary to control Basra to clear a route for crude oil exports. And UPI is reporting British officials believe it would be embarrassing for Prime Minister Tony Blair to meet President George Bush in Belfast today without British troops having substantially taken Basra. British troops have been camped outside Basra for 2 weeks while U.S. troops have rushed 300 miles north to Baghdad. But UPI reports some British officers say they see long-term trouble in reports that more than 2,000 Iraqis were killed by U.S. troops in Saturday's raid into Baghdad. With bitter experience of Northern Ireland, some of the British fear that the number of deaths is too high and could result in recriminations against Britain and the United States that will take many years to overcome. United Nations officials have rebuked British commanders for urging local residents of Basra to loot buildings belonging to the Iraqi army and the ruling Ba'ath Party. The Times of London reports a senior Bush administration officer, a senior British officer, admitted they encourage the looting for propaganda purposes. He said, quote, "We believe this sends a powerful message that the old guard is truly finished." But UN officials said the British are violating the Geneva Convention. Homes and vehicles in Umkasar and Safwan, which have nothing to do with Saddam's regime, have been robbed and vandalized in recent days. The Pentagon on Friday defended special operations troops who are dressing in civilian clothes. The Bush administration accused the Iraqis of war crimes last week because paramilitaries were dressing as civilians. Defense Department spokesperson Victoria Clark was asked at a Pentagon press conference why it's all right for U.S. commando troops to take off their uniforms, but a crime when the Iraqis do it. She said she thought U.S. forces wear something that distinguishes them from civilians and refused to answer the question further. A preliminary investigation of the remains of hundreds of bodies found in an artillery complex near Basra contradicts the Pentagon's claims of war atrocities. The Pentagon initially said the evidence suggested the men were tortured and executed, but U.S. Army investigators looking for war crimes say a preliminary investigation of the remains and paperwork show the Iraqis were processing the remains. At the site, suggests they are the remains of Iranian soldiers killed in the Iran-Iraq war that were being identified and returned to Iran. A U.S. F-16 warplane yesterday bombed a Kurdish convoy traveling with U.S. special forces in northern Iraq, killing at least 18 people. The bomb fell only meters from where the BBC World Affairs editor John Simpson was standing. He said it was, quote, "a scene from hell." Bodies burned around him, pieces of bodies strewn around, vehicles were on fire. The BBC's translator, Kamran Abdurazak Mohammed, was killed, and the BBC's driver lost a leg. Witnesses say at least five of the vehicles in the convoy had blaze orange markings on their roofs, meant to warn U.S. pilots. This according to the New York Times. The three white BBC vehicles had the letters TV spelled out on their hoods. The commander of the special forces of the Peshmerga Kurdish fighters, Waji Barzani, was critically injured. He is the brother of Masoud Barzani, leader of the Kurdistan Democratic Party. Michael Kelly, a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, was killed in Iraq on Friday. The military vehicle in which he was riding came under Iraqi fire. The driver tried to evade the fire, but ran the Humvee off the road and into a canal south of Baghdad, trapping both men for about 25 minutes. Kelly was the first U.S. journalist to die in the war. He was the former editor-in-chief of the Atlantic Monthly and a former Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He was 46 years old. Then NBC's David Bloom collapsed and died Sunday morning. David Bloom was a co-host of the weekend edition of the Today Show and a former White House correspondent for NBC News. He was about 25 miles south of Baghdad and packing gear early in the morning when he suddenly collapsed. Reports are that he died of a pulmonary embolism. He was embedded with the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division. He was 39 years old, leaves a wife and three daughters. Israeli forces have killed two more people in the Gaza Strip near the village of Al-Musadar. One was a 13-year-old boy. Meanwhile, Israeli peace activists criticized the arrival of Jewish families at a settlement in Arab East Jerusalem. It's the first time a Jewish settlement has been built in a Palestinian area of Jerusalem since Israel seized control of the entire city in 1967. They called it a recipe for violence ahead of the release of a U.S.-backed roadmap for peace. An Israeli soldier shot a U.S. peace activist in the face in the West Bank town of Jenin on Saturday. 24-year-old Brian Avery is in serious condition. Another International Solidarity Movement activist who was with Avery said he had his hands in the air and was wearing a vest that clearly identified him as an international worker when the soldiers fired on him. The Israeli army claims a gun battle with Palestinians was going on in the area at the time. In the other hour of Democracy Now!, we have spoken with the man who is with Brian Avery, another International Solidarity Movement activist named Tobias Carlson. He said that there was no firefight at the time. And we turn now to a protest in the streets of New York. Mark Milano is on the line with us. Can you tell us where you are and what's happening? Mark, are you there? Well, we'll talk about the thousands of people who've been protesting around the country. Thousands rallied against the war in Oakland, California over the weekend. Protesters in Italy and Crete also called on their governments to shut down American military bases there. 50,000 marchers protested the war in the Spanish pilgrimage town of Santiago de Compostela. Another 50,000 took place in rallies in Madrid. In Denmark's capital, Copenhagen, anti-war protesters threw human chains around the embassies of the United States, Britain, and Spain. Thousands gathered in London in front of the U.S. Embassy demanding the resignation of British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Anti-war protesters also demonstrated in front of a Royal Navy base in Portsmouth in the south of England. Egyptian police arrested a prominent Egyptian-American civil rights activist and more than a dozen others after trying to hold an anti-war protest outside a mosque in Old Cairo. 10,000 people demonstrated outside Cairo's Al-Azhar Mosque after Friday prayers. Thousands of protesters in Bahrain called on their government to expel the U.S. Navy Fifth Fleet, which is stationed there. Police used tear gas on several thousand protesters in Istanbul. As we try now to reach Mark Milano in the streets of New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark. Mark, are you with us?
Hello?
Hi, Mark. Can you tell us where you are and why you're protesting?
I'm at the corner of 56th and 5th Avenue at the offices of the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group is a major global investment fund that has a lot of money in defense contractors and stands to profit from this war and from the rebuilding of Iraq. They have a very close tie to the government. George Bush Sr., his advisors, also James Baker and Frank Carlucci. So they're very, very tied into this war and are advising the government, actually, on how to conduct this war. What just happened here was something I'd never seen before in over 20 years of protesting. We had people who were being arrested blocking the entrance to the offices and a legal protest across the street of people who were picketing legally. The police moved in, surrounded the legal protest, and refused to let them leave and arrested all of them, 30 or 40 people who had no intention of getting arrested and were legally on the sidewalk, were surrounded by cops. They tried to leave, the cops refused, and arrested them all. It's really upping the ante. We are now officially living in a police state here in New York, and you can't even legally picket on the sidewalk without being arrested. It's just shocking. We're in shock here.
Mark Milano talking to us from the streets of New York. As we turn now to Geneva, Switzerland, to the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross, we're joined by Nada Dumani, spokesperson for the ICRC. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good. It's good to have you with us. The International Red Cross has been putting out reports on what is happening now in Baghdad at the hospitals. Can you describe what you know?
Well, concerning hospitals, undoubtedly that the resources and the staff of these hospitals are being stretched to their limits by the current situation in Baghdad. They are treating several hundred or four wounded per day. And some surgical and medical equipment are starting to lack. I mean, there start to be a shortage of these items. Moreover, as you know, power is off most of the time in Baghdad, so these hospitals are relying on backup generators, and also there is scarcity of water. So the main focus of our colleagues from the International Red Cross in Baghdad is to help compensate for these shortages and to bring in medical items, surgical items to these hospitals in order to face the increasing number of war wounded, plus providing also some water bags, water drinkable bags to the hospitals.
And we're also hearing U.S. Central Command is saying that between 2,000 and 3,000 Iraqi fighters were killed in Saturday's incursion that the United States did into Baghdad. How, is the ICRC monitoring hospitals as well that are housing the casualties of the Iraqi military, or are you only in hospitals that are dealing with civilians?
No, in fact, we're visiting civilian hospitals only. And by the way, apparently there are more military people coming to the civilians' hospitals, so we presume that military hospitals are unable to cope with the increasing number of casualties among the military, too.
We are hardly hearing reports of civilian casualties in the mainstream media in the United States. How do you gather your information?
Well, it's very simple. We are on the ground, and our colleagues go and visit the hospitals, and they see that there are women, there are children among people killed or people injured. So we can say that there are civilians among the casualties.
How would you rate the situation right now in Baghdad? And do you have reports from other cities?
Well, we would say that, as I said, since the hospitals are being stretched to the limits, since water is becoming scarce even in the capital, electricity is off, bombing and shelling are on all the time, you can presume that the situation is quite critical in the capital. Concerning other cities, unfortunately, we're not present except in Basra. We know nothing about what's happening in Nasiriyah, in Najaf, in Karbala. And I mean, I'm only talking about the humanitarian situation there. We really hope you're concerned about these cities. We really hope that the humanitarian situation is still under control.
Well, Nada Dumani, we want to thank you very much for being with us. A spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking to us, Geneva, about what she is hearing from Red Cross workers on the ground in Baghdad. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a roundtable of editors of publications here in this country as we look at the state of the invasion of Iraq as we move into the third week. Stay with us. War, the late Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill, just recently back from Baghdad.
Nice to be with you, Amy. I wanted to say that I was watching some of the Sunday talk shows yesterday, and Paul Wolfowitz was making the rounds and explaining why the United Nations was not going to have a role, essentially an administrative role, in a post-Saddam Iraq, as they refer to it. What's interesting is that this these statements that Wolfowitz is making are happening while Ahmed Chalabi, the highly discredited leader of the Iraqi National Congress, is being deployed in a military aircraft to Nasiriyah in the south of Iraq with, the reports are, 700 members of the Iraqi National Congress military wing. And one Saudi newspaper was commenting that what the United States is essentially hoping to do in Iraq is to make three separate provinces in Iraq, leaded, unleaded, and diesel throughout the country, and that's the kind of federation that they're looking for.
Well, I'm looking at the front page of the Independent newspaper, the British paper. It's a very dramatic front page. It says, "The toll of a war that has taken allies to the gates of Baghdad." It is written in big black print. The numbers are in red. It says, 130,000 British and American troops are in action in Iraq from a total force of 250,000 in the Gulf. The Allies have launched 725 Tomahawk cruise missiles, flown 18,000 sorties, dropped 50 cluster bombs, and discharged 12,000 precision-guided munitions. There have been an estimated 1,252 Iraqi civilian deaths, 57 Kurdish deaths, and 5,103 civilian injuries. 88 Allied troops have been killed in combat, 27 of whom are British. At least 19 Allied soldiers are missing. 41 Allied soldiers have been killed in, quote, friendly fire incidents or battlefield accidents. 9 journalists have been killed or are unaccounted for. There have been 2 suicide attacks on U.S. troops, killing 7 soldiers. 8,023 Iraqi combatants have been taken prisoner of war. So far, 0 weapons of mass destruction have been found. 1,500,000 people in southern Iraq have no access to clean water. 200,000 children in southern Iraq are at risk of death from diarrhea. 17 million Iraqis are reliant on food aid, which has now been stopped. 600 oil wells and refineries are now under British and American control. $80 billion has been set aside by U.S. Congress to meet the cost of war. A capital city of 5 million people now stands between the Allied forces and their one objective, the removal of Saddam Hussein, which brings us to our roundtable discussion. We are joined by the editors of The Nation magazine, Z Magazine, and Counterpunch. Alexander Coburn joins us from the West Coast. We're joined by Michael Albert of Z Magazine in Massachusetts and Katrina Vandenhoevel, who was in Russia during the time of the invasion. Editor of The Nation magazine joins us from New York. I thought we'd start with Katrina Vandenhoevel with this latest news that we're getting about the Russian convoy that was traveling from Baghdad to Syria, including the Russian ambassador to Iraq. This latest news from the BBC, it says a convoy of Russian diplomatic cars shot at while leaving Baghdad was caught in crossfire between U.S. and Iraqi forces, a Russian TV journalist traveling with the convoy has said. Alexander Minikov, speaking from the Iraqi-Jordanian border, said the convoy was passing Iraqi positions on the edge of the city when it came under heavy fire. He said the Iraqis were shelled by coalition forces and returned fire. It's not clear whether the shots that hit the convoy came from U.S. or Iraqi forces, but Russian media reported that 2 bullets from the stomach of one victim came from an M16 semi-automatic assault rifle used by U.S. Marines. The U.S. and Iraqi ambassadors in Moscow were summoned to the foreign ministry following the incident. The matter is expected to be raised with U.S. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, who's arrived for talks in Moscow with top Russian officials today. Can you give us any further information and context to this and what this means for the invasion and the aftermath?
Amy, it's the latest in a series of incidents in a increasingly frayed partnership, alleged strategic partnership between President Vladimir Putin and Bush. I mean, the other day, Anton Stepanenko, a correspondent for Russia's First Channel, which had crew in the convoy, said it had cleared the last Iraqi checkpoint in territory controlled by Iraqi forces before being attacked. There will be a lot of back and forth. As you said, the ambassador has been called into the foreign ministry. Again, that's not the first time. The American ambassador, Mr. Vershbo, is a protege of Condoleezza Rice's. He was called into the foreign ministry the day I left Moscow for the first time since 1996 in protest against U.S. U-2 overflights along Russia's border. I mean, now there's a throwback to the Cold War. But what's happening is that, you know, Putin professed to be Bush's best friend immediately after September 11th. Russia claims to have done more than NATO in terms of the war against Afghanistan. But Putin is now under fire in his own country. His national security policy is viewed by millions, not just the policy elite, for basically consisting of giving the Bush administration one concession after another that's been met only by broken U.S. promises and imperial aggrandizement. I mean, just to conclude, I mean, what you're looking at as you sit in Moscow through the eyes of millions of Russian citizens, by the way, a poll taken hours after the war started shows that 71% view U.S. actions against Iraq as the greatest threat to world peace. 93% oppose the bombing. But they're looking at the garrisoning of U.S. troops and bases in Central Asia, an encirclement of Russia, the shredding of the ABM Treaty, a whole series of broken promises. So now we're seeing opposition to the U.S. war in Iraq being used by Putin in certain ways to reposition himself as a defender of Russia's national interests. But the battle rages because inside the Kremlin there's still this view that to ally themselves with the U.S. may be in their long-term best interests, Russia's best interests. How that fares will depend a lot on what happens in these next weeks and months.
Katrina, what about the issue of Russia and oil? We know that, in the weeks leading up to the U.S. invasion, in fact, in the years leading up to the U.S. invasion, people spoke of the great debt that Iraq has, the amount of money that Iraq owes to Russia, as well as Russia having a very lucrative contract for a southern Iraqi oil field that has gone untapped since the Iran-Iraq war, the Lukoil company. How is Russia viewing this current situation where this attack has taken place with no UN mandate, no NATO mandate? Is Russia viewing itself as having an any kind of a future in Iraqi oil?
Well, the question of the issue of the no UN mandate, the breaking of international law is viewed seriously in Russia. I mean, Russia takes seriously its stake in the United Nations for a number of reasons, and they do see, as so many of us do in this country, that Iraq may well be a pilot project for this doctrine of preemptive war, the shifting and remaking of the international order with Russia being marginalized. There's grave concern about that. On the oil front, it's complicated because Condi Rice, I'm sure, is heading to Moscow with promises about Russia's stake in any future oil reconstruction and maybe repayment of debts that Iraq owes Russia. But the issue of broken promises and how little the Russian government believes the United States at this point will factor in. And finally, the Russian oligarchs, a very important factor in Russian politics, perhaps, you know, even more so under Putin than under the late years of Tsar Yeltsin. They've played a pro-Western role in trying to have their stakes, their debts, their contracts met, serviced in any future reconstruction of Iraq. But again, there's real anxiety and real mistrust of U.S. intentions.
Alexander Coburn of Counterpunch, as you hear the figures on the front page of The Independent, the toll of a war that has taken allies to the gates of Baghdad, and you contrast it with the approach of the U.S. Television networks from Fox to NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN of victory at hand. Your thoughts?
Well, that's to be expected from the networks. Just to go back on that Russian thing, it should be noted that the Russian ambassador himself, Titarenko, says that he believes that that convoy he was in was deliberately fired on by the U.S. That's him saying that, which, of course, brings us back to the attack on the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And some have put the view that the Americans were just saying to the Russians, look, we think that you had jamming devices in your embassy, and you might be taking them out, and therefore it was a deliberate attack. So the Russians are being very vocal, the ambassador himself, about the attack. On the general contrast between the appalling misery that's been unleashed on Iraq and the victory headlines, I mean, it's totally to be expected. I have to say that I think Whereas, I mean, I personally can't watch CNN at all. I don't know how much of your audience can do it. But, I mean, I have access to the BBC and other outlets through the computer. I mean, I think most of American television is as unwatchable as would have been, I don't know, listening to Lord Haw Haw in the Second World War. It's absolutely intolerable. But I think, in general, you can get a lot of good reporting out of Iraq. There have been the BBC, Bob Fisk, I have to say, my brother in northern Iraq, and other people. The British press, The Guardian writers haven't been bad, and there have been some very courageous and rather good reporting. Some papers like the London Sunday Times, of all things, had the single best report of the entire war, I think a classic that will be in anthologies of any war reporting for the next 50 years, which is by Mark Franchetti. You probably dealt with it on your show, but I didn't hear you.
Let me ask you, Alexander, have you spoken to your brother Patrick Coburn about the attack on the Kurdish U.S. convoy that was traveling that has injured and killed many, including the BBC reporter's translator was killed? Right.
Yeah, no, we, as soon as I saw the report, obviously, we tried to email him. He obviously was not with that particular group. I mean, what happened there was that there was a Kurdish group, and John Simpson, the BBC guy, and his translator was with him, and it was an attack by a U.S. plane which killed the Simpson's translator, slightly wounded Simpson, and killed several other people. It was obviously an appalling scene. 3 days ago, there was another similar incident where another BBC fellow got out of his car, and his translator stepped on a landmine and was killed. So obviously, Arbil, which is where they've been in the north, is not at all a safe place.
Just on the reporting, it's interesting that in Moscow, two things in the recent weeks have gotten a lot of attention. One was the firing of Phil Donahue. Vladimir Posner, the longtime Russian broadcaster, called this America's new McCarthyism. But more recently, Peter Arnett's firing got a lot of attention on all the broadcasts and in the papers in Moscow. And what's interesting is there are a lot of parallels being drawn between Brezhnev's Russia and Bush's America, both in terms of a belief that the Brezhnev Doctrine, as it was called from the Soviet invasion of Prague in 68 until the rise of Gorbachev in 85, which asserted that countries in the Soviet orbit, primarily in Eastern Europe, had only limited sovereignty, and therefore that Moscow alone had the right to decide the nature of those countries' political regimes. It's pointed out in Moscow that that's an early version of Washington's current doctrine of preemptive war and regime change. And finally, just on the TV, you know, a lot of the TV there draws on Al Jazeera or the BBC. A lot of it on, it's interesting, internet sites from this country. For example, the rumor as I left Moscow was that Cheney's daughter was in Jordan, on her way.
It was
on her way to being a human shield in Baghdad. But what was striking was that these were not underground internet sites. These were the two or three main quasi-state-controlled channels reporting this story in the few days right after the war started.
Amy, I'd like to add to that. Actually, it is true for anyone following on the internet that the best reporting on the military situation consistently has been relayed from Russian military intelligence, which I'm sure many of your audience have been looking at, which is aeronautics.ru and the other one. Actually, I think almost for the first time, one can get a fairly realistic assessment on a day-to-day basis of what's been going along on the ground. But it is true that the very last place to get any kind of a picture of the suffering in Iraq, any kind of a picture of the realities of war, would be the major American media.
Michael Albert, you're the founder and current member of the staff of Z Magazine. Among your pieces after the Turkey shoot, we've just heard from the Red Cross, Iraq casualties too high to count. The hospitals in Baghdad have stopped counting the number of people treated. Your response?
I actually think that at the beginning, the U.S. was trying to minimize casualties. I think that's pretty evident. But I think that the reason for that is being missed. The reason for that certainly isn't that the United States government is morally concerned about the well-being of the Iraqi people. If that was the case, we wouldn't have engaged in a set of policies that killed roughly 1 million of them over the last decade. No, I think the reason for that is concern about public relations, is concern about the impact of civilian casualties, direct civilian casualties, actual maiming and killing of people by explosives on anti-war opposition. So I think that actually it's a victory of opposition around the world, a small one, a modest one, that there was a degree of attentiveness to trying to minimize civilian casualties at the outset. That's slowly disappearing. I think it's going to go entirely away if the Iraqi resistance holds up. And then we'll see something that's more familiar from the past, as in carpet bombing and the like. But I do think that what's at stake here is, or what's operating here, is largely not the smaller day-to-day details, which is very easy to focus on and which have their own importance, but the broad situation. The United States wants to create a changed set of norms for international relations in which violence and force, which we monopolize, rule. Anti-war movements and peace and justice movements around the world want to oppose that outcome. And that's the large-scale enveloping struggle. When the Russian government or the French government or the German government, for whatever complicated set of reasons, seems to drift away from the direction that you'd expect Washington to want, you'd think that they would count that as a serious cost of what they're doing. But what they're doing is trying to send a message to everybody. You don't have to like us. You don't have to appreciate us. You don't have to, think anything positive about us at all, as long as you're scared of us. And that message is being communicated. And unless anti-war movements can put the brakes on this kind of approach, it's hard to see, where it leads except downhill. Today's CNN, on the right-hand side, there's something about tanks. This is on the Internet, like Alex. I just can't watch it on TV. There's something about tanks entering Baghdad and so on. But on the left-hand side, there's a little article about the stock market prepared to reach great highs and to celebrate the taking of Baghdad. Well, that's pretty interesting.
The economy, if I can say something, I mean,
Alexander Coburn.
Yeah, the U.S. economy is in terrible shape.
Yeah.
You're probably going to have two negative months back-to-back. Consumer spending is way down, and consumer spending was the only thing holding the whole situation up. The market isn't really an indicator. And if you have a housing slump, as many people expect, the economy is going to be really in the toilet. So the background news of Imperial America's economic well-being is absolutely appalling. That you wouldn't learn that from watching TV.
But I mean, it's also, it's what's so appalling, and you read a profile of Wolfowitz in the Washington Post today, and I have to say there's been some decent reporting in the print press.
In the what?
In the print press, in the mainstream print press. If you work hard, you can see some of it. I mean, there was a story about how there's no sign of weapons of mass destruction, even though the United States has gone to the top 10 sites given to them by their leading intelligence. But, I mean, the idea that this government is going to lead some democratization nation-building in Iraq or in parts of the Middle East is so obscene in light of its failure to do anything close to nation-building. Rather, they're rolling back all kinds of government services in this country and undermining democracy, as fragile as it is already in this country. And now they're going to bring an educational system. They have, 23 offices in this Office of Reconstruction run by retired General Jay Garner, with all of his conflicts of interest and ties to the Israeli right and military. So I think that, as Michael talks about the limitations or the early limitations on civilian casualties, I would attribute that also to this desire on the part of this government to win the hearts and minds of this region, which they failed miserably in doing because of the Al Jazeera effect, as it's called, and other effects of real reporting on what's happening. So I think, and also finally the occupation, which we're now coming up to, that's where the economy is going to factor in a way too. I mean, this country, it seems to me, is not going to sustain the kinds of billions of dollars in costs that this kind of occupation run by these extremists who've hijacked our foreign policy or calling for.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves, and we're going to come back to this discussion. Katrina Vandenhoevel is the editor of The Nation magazine. Michael Albert is a co-founder and staff member of Z Magazine, and Alexander Coburn is editor of Counterpunch. We'll be back in a minute.
They got a student suicide singing, oh my God. In my mind, they got a student genocide singing, oh my God. In my mind, they got a student suicide singing, oh my God, oh my God. Slam, bam, I come on the scene, but like gasoline, you can tell I'm in the tank, like money in the bank. I smell appealing, but I'm toxic, can send you reeling without an inkling. Keep you thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds, left your school district for dead. You up in the head, but still they saying nothing's wrong. Selling fire water by outlawing the bong. Still believing the system is working, while half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets and coats of judges and jurors from Frisco to Jersey. Threats and protests, politicians, mob debts, trumped up charges and phony arrests. Staged a lethal injection the night before the election, because he got donation from the prison guards.
Michael Franti, oh my God, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scaho, and you can go to our website, democracynow.org, and check out the interview with Michael Franti and how federal authorities have been questioning the band members of Spearhead after they perform. Michael Franti, a well-known musician and anti-war activist. We are talking with Alexander Coburn of Counterpunch, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine, and Michael Albert of Z magazine. Katrina, you mentioned Jay Garner in this weekend's Financial Times. The headline, "The American Waiting to Step into Saddam's Shoes." It says the Bush administration's choice of a missile defense contractor with close ties to Israel as its interim governor in Baghdad has stirred controversy, mostly outside the United States. But the last time Jay Garner was in Iraq in the messy aftermath of the first Gulf War, he was treated as a hero. As the armored noose of the U.S. coalition tightens around Baghdad, there are two governments in waiting in the north and south, posed to launch the post-Saddam Hussein era of Iraqi history. And then it talks about the incongruous setting of a Hilton Beach resort on the Kuwaiti coast. Garner, a retired lieutenant general heading the Pentagon's new Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, or OHRA, is ensconced with scores of mostly American advisors in a line of beachfront chalets. And the latest news, he's canceled the first news conference that would launch U.S. occupation government. Your comment about Jay Garner.
Well, I mean, this exposes the lie of this idea of democratizing, bringing democracy to the region. If you have these people like Jay Garner, and then Jim Woolsey is being touted about, the former head of the CIA, all of this is going to play in a region which the United States has now inserted itself in as a kind of, you know, the imperial power, to fuel the anti-Americanism that is growing by leaps and bounds. And as Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, no raving radical, has said, creating hundreds of Osama bin Ladens. I think that, you know, we should argue that no U.S. officials with ties to the Pentagon or to arms manufacturers whose weapons are currently deployed against Iraqi should be allowed anywhere near any post-war humanitarian position. And finally, you know, let this whole issue we were talking about, the economy, why should the poor and the working poor in the United States, the working people, support their tax dollars being used to pay for rebuilding schools, roads, hospitals destroyed by the United States, the Bush administration in Iraq, when those things are also crumbling in the United States? Fund a reconstruction program through a 50% excess profit windfall for war tax on all contracts offered to U.S. corporations, Bechtel, Halliburton, what is Garner's, the Psy Technologies. let's do some of that to expose, for what it is, the lie of bringing these kinds of people into any process involving humanitarian or reconstruction efforts.
Alexander Coburn.
A couple of actually quite sharp insights on economic planning in Iraq, which we ran on our website, counterpunch.org, is one, in the port of Umm Qasr, desperately trying to organize to bring in shipments there, that the person in charge of recruiting Iraqi labor has said that the previous wage, this is an American guy, the previous wage of 25 cents an hour is way, way too much. And the ILWU on the West Coast has said that actually what's going on here is actually, they said Umm Qasr is being subjected to exactly the same pressures, of course, rather smaller sums of money involved, as they recently faced on the West Coast, that the Iraqi wage is being dismissed by the Allies as far too high for local labor. The second one was, you may have seen a report at one point that water, which the kindly British were distributing or trying to distribute to the city they were besieging after having tried to destroy its water supplies in Basra, was being sold by Iraqi truck drivers. In the American press, that was portrayed as, you know, cynical, taking advantage of an emergency by Iraqi press drivers. But actually, there were reports that an American colonel had advised the Iraqi truck drivers to sell the water on the grounds that was introducing principles of the free market into what had previously been a protected Iraqi economy. And the third story was there was an American chaplain who was giving water to American troops, but only under conditions that they first were baptized in the water in this particular place. But all of these indicate a sort of wild megalomania on the part of the coalition in reordering Iraq. You have to go right back to the British arrival in the same area in 1917, 1918, where they made exactly the same speeches about liberating the area in the wake of the Ottoman Empire and introducing Western principles of democracy. And 3 years later, of course, there was an immense Iraqi uprising in 1920, which unified the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds. And I think if you look down the road, I mean, they're fighting in Baghdad right now, but if they do prevail, you'll see a situation rather like Baghdad, rather like Beirut.
Yeah.
When the Israelis went into Beirut, you'll see a period of savagery, such as is going on, in which many, many civilians will be killed and buildings knocked down. Then you'll see a great victory declared. Then you'll have a pause, and then you'll have fairly unrelenting assault by guerrilla forces, and you'll see the gradual descent of the place into utter misery, as happened in Beirut, at the end of which time, I think, opinion around the world in the U.S., and obviously the peace movement will have a lot to do this, they will say, is this worth the cost? And then you'll see, hopefully, the craven-hearted Democrats will start campaigning for withdrawal from a useless and expensive war.
Let me just add two things.
Michael Albert of Z Magazine.
On this issue of democracy, it's hard for me to even fathom the use of the word in this context. But all we have to do is ask, what would happen if there was serious responsiveness to the will of the populace throughout the Mideast? What would be the result of that? Well, one of the first results would be throwing out American troops, bases, and beachheads of all kinds, much less an invasion. Is this something that the United States is going to freely, without pressure, bring into being? No, it's the exact opposite of what we want. There is no intention whatsoever to institute democracy, serious democracy, any place in the region. That's not in the cards. It's not what this is being done for. So it's just a rhetorical flourish.
There are other words that shouldn't, in some ways, that are misused. The coalition, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, it should be the Anglo-American.
Katrina,
forces.
We just want to interrupt you for one moment. We have reached Baghdad. We have the correspondent for Agence France-Presse, Nayla Razouk, on the phone. Nayla, welcome to Democracy Now! What is the latest in Baghdad?
Hello. Well, it's now 5 to 6 in the afternoon in Baghdad, and we're still hearing clashes or, let's say, explosions and artillery fire, and but we don't know really what's going on, because the whole area of the presidential compound is cordoned off.
Are you still there?
Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead. You've been describing what the fighting has been like in the streets this weekend in your reports.
Yes, the latest we have is that there seems to be clashes around the Al Rashid Hotel, which is a landmark in Baghdad. It's where all the foreign media used to stay in previous conflicts, and which was now deserted for a few weeks now, as the whole media moved to another towering hotel on the other side of the bank. There seems to be clashes using assault rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, and we saw a few cars damaged, but it's not really clear who is firing in the area. We saw a lot of Iraqi paramilitary troops firing, but we don't know who they are clashing with. It's not clear yet if there are American troops there or if it's some other party.
Also, we're seeing photos and pictures of American tanks and armored vehicles along the west banks of the Tigris River. Are you able, from where you are at the Palestine Hotel, to see an American military presence in Baghdad?
Yes, actually, we can see at least four, in the naked eye, we can see at least four Bradley tanks on the western bank of the Tigris, which is on the riverside of the presidential compound, which is the Saddam Hussein's main seat of power, where he has many palaces and buildings, official buildings, and which is where the incursion took place, and we saw at least 10 Marines in full gear, wearing helmets, fully armed, on the premises.
And have you been able to visit the hospitals this weekend? A description.
Yes, actually, we've been visiting hospitals, and we've seen actually very gruesome sights of people killed in morgues and other people wounded, hundreds of wounded, severely wounded by shelling, by shrapnel, by glass wounds, gunshots, anything you would expect in a scene of war.
And the electricity, which affects whether you have clean water?
There are also electricity cuts and water cuts, and it's been affecting people's life in Baghdad, as residents are not really equipped with generators. Their financial means are not enough for them to buy small generators. Here, if you can see, you would be able to realize that people here earn an average salary of $20 per month.
Nayla Razouk,
they cannot afford to buy generators.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us directly from Baghdad. We'll have more reports tomorrow of Agence France-Presse. You can go to afp.com. I want to thank Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine, her website, thenation.com. Zmag.org is Michael Alberts, and counterpunch.org, Alexander Coburn. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Noah Ribal, and Sharif. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening.
Oh my God. Listening to my